comprehend him. The other reason we're doing this is we want you to understand that science and the Bible, science and faith are friends. The message the world gives you today is that science has kind of done away with religion. Scientists don't need God. Well, that is garbage. That is just not true. And so we want you to hear a perspective that science and faith are in alignment. Science is a friend of the Bible, and you're going to see that today. So let me pray for you guys, and then you come up as we go for it. Heavenly Father, we come to you and we thank you that in Jesus, everything has done that needed to be done so that we could be forgiven and stand free and clean before you. Lord, I pray that you would still our hearts and our minds, that you wouldn't allow there to be anything that distracts us this morning. Lord, I pray for Dee Dee and for Jack that you would speak through them, give them your words. Lord, I pray that we would be awestruck as we look at the universe around us. And when we stop and think about it, everything in the universe ultimately points to you. Give us a sense of awe. But then, Lord, also give us a sense of courage that we don't roll over and act intimidated when the world tells us that science shoots down the Bible. That's not true. So, Lord, open our hearts, open our minds today. And I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, guys.
Okay, thank you, Mark. It's a little weird being up here because normally I'm up in the media booth and kind of working behind the scenes, but it's a privilege for Jack and I to come up and talk about this topic. I did a similar talk a number of years ago in Cornerstone, so for those of you who have heard that talk, I may be repeating myself a little bit, but it's going to be much more improved because I've got Jack now to add to a number of topics here. So my background is I have an undergraduate in physics and then a graduate degree in imaging science. So I'm going to talk a little bit here about some of the topics here in modern physics and cosmology, which is the study of the universe. And then Jack's going to focus in on biology and some topics in evolution here in a little bit. So first of all, how many folks here have a science and engineering background? Okay, good. How many of you treat it here as a complete foreign language? Okay, so first of all, I promise there won't be any equations, and telling Jeff we won't make you feel like you're back in science class in high school, but we do want to talk to you about what's going on in the world of science, and really, is there a perception that science and Christianity conflict? Because I would say some on both sides, both on the Christian side and as well as on the scientific side, want to create that conflict. They want to say that those are two mutually exclusive areas, and that, again, and some folks on the Christian side is, oh, you can't trust any of those scientists, you know, they're all atheists, they're gonna be attacking our religion, so just don't believe anything they say. And on the other side with the scientists, you know, those guys, Christians, they're just out of their minds, we have scientific proof here, and what they believe in can't possibly be compatible with what we are studying in science. So unfortunately, I think there is that perception and it gets propagated a little bit here in terms of that conflict between science and Christianity. So what Jack and I want to do over the next two lessons of the show is, as Mark said, we don't think these really conflict. In fact, when you dig into the real science and not the pseudo-popular cultural science you might see over with Bill Nye, the science guy, that the two worldviews are actually in pretty good alignment, especially with some of the recent discoveries. And after all, you know, it's the same God that we worship here also designed not only our universe, but the fundamentals of physics and math. Why shouldn't they be compatible? So let me just ask you this. Why is it important to kind of address this topic? Why are we up here? Why are Jack and I up here talking about this? Again, this is the interactive service, I was told by Mark. So any comments there on why is it important to address this area? Okay, I will start with one. Because in Matthew 22:37, it says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And so that last part is what we're going to focus on, because God does not say, you know, when you become a Christian, just throw away rational thought and what you have in your mind, but really to use your mind and that understanding to appreciate his creation. And so I believe, and I'll show you in a little bit here, there have been quite a few scientists over the years who have really taken that verse literally and said, with my mind, I'm going to discover what God has created. And because that we have, because we have a God and a creator and design, there must be a way to go carry out scientific discoveries to understand that. The second part is, as I mentioned, popular culture right now is intentionally, I believe, pitting science against God, and a lot of it comes under this form of new atheism. And although atheism still represents a very small minority opinion, it's gotten a boost with books like this. If you can't see the titles, it says "The God Delusion," "God Is Not Great," and "God: The Failed Hypothesis." So if you look at those books out there, they're certainly not, I would say, friendly to the Christian cultures. And these so-called new atheists, they really are just popular authors that claim and use science to support atheism and really make the claim that religion cannot withstand the withering investigations by the methods of modern science. Well, this new atheism is really the old atheism, and again, it's really just taking a particular worldview and using science to try to justify that worldview. And again, all these folks who wrote these books are great scientists in the sense of their scientific field, but what they've done is really gone beyond their field into the field of theology and given their personal opinion and their worldview. And so their credibility in that should be really no more credibility if they went into economics and predicted the stock market's going to go up, you know, 1,000 points or whatever. And what I'm trying to say here is, you know, scientists generally are perceived as smart, but as I tell my kids sometimes, just because you're smart doesn't mean you know everything. And so in this case, we got to be aware that there is this popular culture with books like that out there that are trying to, again, pit religion, science against religion. So again, why is this important? Well, one of the things is I went out and looked at the National Academy of Science website. And these folks, along with the National Research Council, which is part of the National Academy of Science, as you can see, has a lot of influence on our education system. And it's pretty clear from that quote that you guys can read up there that they are not in favor of creationism or intelligence designer. They really are, again, projecting a worldview here that they are now trying to keep that out of the classroom and saying science is science and there's no room for having a fact that there is perhaps an intelligence designer behind that. Now, the National Academy of Science is made up of about 2,000 members, and in a recent survey, maybe no surprise, 93% of those National Academy of Scientists are identified as atheists. However, if you look at a broader Pew study among the entire scientific folks out there in the U.S., about 50% of them, so only 50% of them would identify themselves as atheists. So what's happening is this National Academy of Science, which is about 0.1% of all the scientists in the U.S., which has, I'll say, a little bit of a skewed view, has a large influence on what we're teaching in school. Again, I'm not trying to bash the National Academy of Science in any way. I'm just trying to make sure we understand as Christians how things work in the scientific community and how certain worldviews are used to, you know, influence our kids' curriculum. So the question is, has it always been this way? Has science and religion always been at odds? And the answer is no. Many of the greatest scientists in history were Christians or had certainly biblical ideas behind them driving their discovery. As I showed in the other quote with Matthew, they really literally said, hey, we need to take our minds and use that for the goodness of God and use it to discover his creation. And so their faith was really a driving force behind their discovery. So I've listed a number of key scientists out there. Hopefully you can read them, and some of the names you'll recognize. For example, one of them, Isaac Newton, I got a quote here. He said, "The most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." So these scientists here were all believers, and they really used the fact that because there's rational order from an intelligent designer or creator, they can go off and make these scientific discoveries. So what happened is around the mid-19th century, something called scientific materialism came about. And it was popularized, and it actually came about right at about the same time as Darwinism came along. But basically, the scientists all assumed that the universe existed forever. It has always been here, and they've had these basic particles. And because the universe has always been around for so long, there's been enough time for these particles to start forming into more complex organisms, and then these organisms evolved into humans. And therefore, because this whole evolution, the whole fact of God was something created from humans and not vice versa. So that's got popularized, with Darwinism in the mid-19th century. And I think we'll leave Jack here to talk a little bit about creation versus evolution. But that really took hold and really formed a lot of fundamental thought for the scientific community as they went forward. And again, in their minds, all there was what we see, what's in the natural sciences, and nothing beyond that. What's happened since then, I believe, with a lot of the recent discoveries, is there has been a lot of evidence for design in a number of scientific fields. The first one, which is physics and cosmology, which I'll talk a little bit about, kind of integrates, you know, the fundamental behavior of our world and how the universe came to be. Discoveries in here in origin of life and how complex the biological system is, the DNA and so on, which again Jackson cover, has shown a lot of proof, I believe, that there is really an intelligent designer behind the science that we've all studied here. The one area that I want to really talk about that I believe is really interesting is an area called quantum mechanics. So if folks have heard of that term, quantum mechanics. It was really developed in the early 20th century, so it kind of came after this scientific materialism. But one of the things a lot of folks say about Christianity is that, you know, Christians believe odd and possible things, you know, where science is completely rational and logical and explains everything that we observe in the world without odd and impossible things. Those folks have not really studied quantum mechanics. It really is an interesting field. It looks at things that are very small scale, subatomic level, but it's really been widely accepted as a theory, and quantum mechanics is used in everything from the design of the circuits in your iPhone to ultra-precise clocks and GPS. So this is a theory that has been proven over and over again as valid. And while it's widely applied, nobody really understands how to interpret the meaning of quantum mechanics. And so I've taken some quotes here from folks who have worked and developed this field. These are guys who actually have invented so-called quantum mechanics. And this first quote is from Niels Bohr, and he basically said, hey, if you understand quantum mechanics, it really hasn't profoundly shocked you, and you haven't understood it yet. Richard Feynman, which is another very famous physicist, atheist physicist, but he would say, I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics. And this last quote, which hopefully folks will recognize this guy up there, it says, if quantum theory is correct, it signifies the end of physics as a science. So that's pretty profound coming from folks like this who, again, many folks in scientific community would like to say, you know, science is all rational and everything and has nothing to do with, you know, weird stuff that you see in the Bible or the religion. So why is quantum mechanics so odd? And I'll give you a couple examples here. The first one is what we call the light as both a wave and a particle. And basically what it says, I don't want to get too much into the technical details here, but light can be treated both as a wave and a particle. And sometimes you need to treat light as a wave, such as in a rainbow, because that's how you get a rainbow. Light goes through essentially a prism and disperses into different wavelengths and gives you very nice, Nice picture here. Again, for us who believe in the Bible, we know what the rainbow really means, right? Out of what Noah saw after the ark, after the flood. But light here is treated as a wave. In other instances, light is a particle, and one of the things they use is what they call the photoelectric effect. And basically, this is how your camera on your phone works. A light particle comes in from whatever you're taking a picture of it. It hits the detector. It sends an electron, ejects an electron out, and this creates a charge, and this charge isn't picked up as a one or a zero. And these ones or zeros are built up in those very various pixels you see, and it creates a picture for you. So a theory of taking pictures, digital pictures, and everything else is all based on the fact that light is a particle. So in essence, light is a particle and a wave simultaneously. It's two things at the same time together. And that is a widely accepted theory in quantum mechanics. So I thought about this and read about it a little bit. And so how does that apply back to the Bible and all those crazy things that we think about, think that's true in the Bible? So I looked at this verse here. It says, "For in Christ all the fullness of the deity lives in bodily form." So that's one of the key principles we hold true, is God, Jesus is both fully man and fully God. To me, that and quantum mechanics showing that light is both particle and a wave are not two incompatible ideas. Second interesting thing about quantum mechanics is what we call a tunneling effect. So normally in classic physics, if you want to get over a hill, you got to, you know, kind of go up over the top of the hill, come over to the top, and come back down. In quantum physics, they have something called tunneling effect, which basically says a particle can actually go through that hill, which is really a barrier of energy, and get it out to the other side. Again, that's just not some theory. That's actually used in a lot of circuit theory and how circuits are built based on this theory. So I said, that's an interesting thing. Things that can actually tunnel through and walk through walls. Where have we seen that? So, and John, sorry, got off the verse there, but though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." So again, scientists, Jesus walking, crazy idea. Yet, quantum mechanics, things are allowed to tunnel through barriers, and people have no problem with that. There are a number of other things in quantum mechanics I won't go into. Some of you may have heard of Schrodinger's cat, and for those cat lovers, I intentionally didn't put a picture of that because I don't want to get anybody upset. But basically, that says, you know, a cat can be both alive and dead when it's not being observed in an experiment that Schrodinger set up. And what that really said is in the past, experiments were done where or the scientists believed that, you know, what happens whether there's an observer there or not doesn't matter. The world goes on as it is. What quantum mechanics says is the observer really now interacts and plays a role in the experiment. And so that brings up a lot of interesting philosophical questions that if an observer is needed now for physical systems to happen, and we'll talk a little bit about the Big Bang here in a little bit, but in the beginning, obviously none of us were around, for that event to happen, there had to be an observer to interact with that. Does that sound familiar, right? So again, quantum mechanics is one of my favorite areas for physics to study. And next time somebody says, "Oh, you know, science is all rational and logical," you know, ask them if they really understand quantum mechanics. Another area of study that's kind of come out of quantum mechanics is string theory, and this is really used to help reconcile quantum mechanics at the very small level and macroscopic events like gravity at the other level, and making sure that those two theories are compatible. And what string theory says is there's really more than just our three dimensions plus time. There's really 11 dimensions that really describe our world. And an example, and I didn't bring a prop here, but an example, you know, how can there be 11 dimensions? Well, imagine I had a very thin piece of floss or string sitting up here. And from folks back in the back seats, what does it look like? It looks like a two-dimensional line. But when you get up close, you can actually see structure in that string, and it's actually three dimensions. That's basically what the theory says, is as you get to small microscopic scales, additional dimensions come out and are revealed. And really that everything we see are really strings that vibrate at different energy levels that create different particles. So the interesting part about here is one of the co-creators of string theory, Dr. Kaku, after going through this, said, hey, I've concluded that we are in a world made by rules created by an intelligence. So again, one of the, and this guy, you know, certainly is an, it's not a Christian, so he's an atheist, and Jack and I were debating whether he's actually, this has changed his worldview or not, but certainly he's not biased from a Christian perspective, yet as a creator or co-creator of string theory, he clearly identifies this as an intelligence that has made this. And one other area in terms of recent physics, and this was more on the cosmology or design of the universe, is what we call dark energy or dark matter. And what folks have seen through various observations from Hubble telescopes and other telescopes that we've launched into space is that what we see and observe only makes up 5% of the universe. The rest is composed of dark matter and dark energy, and that composition is unknown. And the reason why they say that is from these observations, they see that our universe is expanding. However, if we just looked at the matter in our universe, and by the laws of gravity, we should be collapsing. So something out there, a dark matter or dark energy, is causing this universe to expand. And so there's a lot of speculation on what it is. I don't think any of the scientists right now really understand exactly what that composition is. But clearly, something is acting in our universe that we don't see. So I went and thought about what's an interesting verse in the Bible that might relate to this. And again, sorry for the cutoff, but in Hebrews, it says, by faith we understand the universe was formed at God's command, and so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. So again, these discoveries in modern physics, it seems to be supported by a lot of the things that we believe in the Bible. So back to the fact that Jack and I don't believe that Christianity and science, especially with these modern discoveries, are really at odds. But perhaps the biggest discovery, and I'm sure most of you guys are familiar with this, is the Big Bang. And it's pretty much been confirmed by lots of various experiments and instrumentation that we've put up. In fact, that picture is taken by that Cosmic Background Explorer that NASA launched, and really is a snapshot of the entire known universe, and a different color shows the density of matter as we look out into the earliest stretches of space and time. But again, the Big Bang basically says, and it's, again, not the TV show, but the scientific theory, says that time, space, matter, everything all came into existence at once. It's not really just a random explosion, but it was really planned and controlled because it had to inflate and accelerate at a certain rate for the universe, for the galaxies and solar systems, everything else to exist. And we'll get into this more next week, but these were a lot of fine-tuned parameters that were had to happen for this to exist, for life to come into existence out of this Big Bang. The other important thing is it was really decided that time is a created dimension. In other words, back to the thought that scientific materialism said, hey, time had always existed, it clearly pointed out that time had a finite beginning and it did not always exist. And as I mentioned, in the end, the universe continues to expand and there's that dark energy around us. So out of the Big Bang, there's just a whole host of things you can draw from the Bible and obviously in Genesis that seem rather compatible, and I've just picked a couple here. Obviously, the first one, this Big Bang is really just confirming what we knew in Genesis 1:1. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In Titus 1:2, it says, the hope of eternal life, which God, who does not lie, promised before the beginning of time. So remember what I talked about in the Big Bang, saying, hey, time has a finite start. God is obviously outside of our dimension, our time, and therefore, as this verse says, God was able to do that before the beginning of time. There was a finite start of time. And then Isaiah 42:5, thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out. So again, the inflationary theory of the universe that pretty much has been proven with various observations was talked about in Isaiah. So I believe from physics and some of the modern theories and cosmology that there really is a lot of compatibility between a designer and creator and what we're seeing, in what we believe as Christians and in the Bible, and there certainly isn't that conflict. There's only the perception of that conflict from certain folks who have a particular worldview they like to, I'll frankly say, push upon the rest of us. And so I just want to make sure that we as believers have the confidence that the latest scientific theories and what they've seen in there really is not against the Bible. In fact, you would say a lot of that supports what the Bible says. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Jack, and he's going to talk a little bit about biology and evolution. But before that, I do want to answer any questions, because I see Jeff raises his hand now. So I don't know if there, maybe there's certain connotations with the Big Bang Theory that may or may not, the words itself may or may not agree with some Christian principles, if that's what you're getting at. I think the concept is very much in harmony with what we read in Genesis, that number one, there is, life and everything else came out of nothing. Now, if you're an atheist physicist, you'll say, and there's other theories called multiple universes, which says, hey, we have multiple universes out there, and out of all the random multiple universes, life happened to come. So they've come up with some other justifications to say, here's why it was a Big Bang Theory. Now, again, there's no way to prove that, and again, it's a certain worldview. As a Christian, I would say that what we see in Genesis and what we see in the theory of the Big Bang, maybe the term's wrong, is there was a creator out there somewhere that used the Big Bang to create our universe, our galaxy, our solar system, and ultimately life. And as we'll talk about, that there are a lot of factors that had to happen that wasn't just a coincidence for life to eventually come out of the Big Bang. And I think it kind of, back to that scientific materialism, if we believed that time existed forever and the universe has always been around, then a lot of the arguments have said, okay, given enough time, through random events and so on, life will have happened. I think the fact that the Big Bang said, hey, there isn't an infinite amount of time, there's only a finite amount of time for things to happen, and we'll show you later on, the odds that things randomly happened are so high, are so impossible, you can only indicate that a creator or intelligence design really put life here on this planet. Is there any other questions before I turn over to Jack? And if there are any questions that you guys have on the Science of the Bible, we have another session next week. Please see Jack or I afterwards, and we can either try to discuss it or we can try to incorporate into our discussion next week. But with that, I want to turn it over to Jack to talk a little bit on the biology and evolution side.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. And actually, a real quick point, Jeff, as a backup. An interesting note about the Big Bang itself. The term was actually used as a derisive term to try and prove that the Big Bang itself didn't actually happen. A guy named Frank Hoyle came up with the concept, on a radio program, and derisively said something about a Big Bang. And actually a Christian came out much later and pointed out an interesting point. He said, if you were to describe God speaking into the universe to create it, what better word than to say bang? So think of it along that line. Our understanding has changed over time, as a matter of fact. So the one and only gotcha question I'll ask as we actually start this, I'm going to get a drink of water. What was the name of the first satellite to orbit the Earth, and who built it? What was that? The moon. I would actually challenge you to say that it's actually the moon. God created the moon way back when. You stole my line. Congratulations. So it's an interesting way to think about it. The connection between science and God. Are they necessarily different? Aren't they all the same? Don't we look at them kind of along the same lines? See if I make this thing work. Okay, so first of all, I'm gonna give a shout out to Sue, who's back there somewhere. She actually came up with this design. I loved it, and she also came up with the title. So give her the credit for the actual title, the Science by Design, and the actual picture, which I think, unfortunately, is cooler than my background, so I'll have to stick with what I got. So my portion is gonna be something along the lines of the unlikelihood of life in the universe. Next week, I'm gonna concentrate a little bit more on the unlikeliness of its continuance here on the Earth. Things to remember. Okay, first of all, I'm not a biologist. I'm a Marine, guys. Come on. Just, as far away as you could possibly get. And most of y'all are not trained biologists in here as well. But I'd also point out a simple fact. Isn't that the point? Isn't that the point of what we do? Apologetics and simple reason do not require degrees. What it requires is a degree of interest. And isn't that what Training Ground is all about? Actually, interactive on a daily basis. So keep that in mind as we look at these things. So for those who are familiar with the picture of the DNA sequence, the ladder, all these things, we'll go a little bit into it. Don't worry, we're not going to deal with all the intricacies. I can't even spell or say half the words in there anyways. But the point is, T, A, G, and C, when I say those letters, what do those mean to me? Well, we'll look a little bit at that. We're also going to understand how this kind of all blends together and gives us a better idea of what science, life itself, and God have to do with each other. Things to consider, and I'm going to hit on this point a little bit more at the end, but and we've already seen this a few times, but the biggest point I want to take away is that first point, the fact that God, that science, that faith and understanding are not incompatible. Man's understanding of it might be, and our interpretations over time, how we understand things like the Big Bang, how we understand how science itself works and what genetics itself does, that may change over time, but that's a wholly different issue. So when looking at these things, one of the things that Didi was describing earlier, and I want to pound on again, is this concept that the new atheists have about morality. In the attempts, people like Sam Harris and some of his books, he's tried to point out the fact that morality can be explained by scientific methods. What that does is it can equate and push God out of it by us defining what these ideas are. The problem is defining morality via science gets you into trouble automatically. And some smart guys, like Mr. Einstein here, came up with these ideas way back before even he did. And he points out both of these problematic statements. Science itself will not give you the understanding that you need to form these bases of morality. It's been tried time and time again. People have said the only thing we should consider are scientific equations and those things that can be proved scientifically. Well, the statement itself that we should only use those things itself is not scientific, nor is it an equation-based idea, and therefore you're already defeating your own arguments as you go along. It's a good idea to try and think of where your morality comes from, but one cannot make too many assumptions along the way. I think that's the whole. And Einstein points that out, I think, very well by saying, every attempt to reduce ethics to scientific formula must fail, and indeed, must fail along the way. So let's get a little bit into the actual chemistry and all the background, all that biology stuff. When we start talking about some of these general ideas, we start talking about the organic soup. And there's probably some concepts, and I'll get into a little bit more of it in a minute, but people probably heard these things before. So I'm going to ask you, is this what you think of when you think of organic soup? An experiment, somebody putting together crazy formulas and zapping it in some kind of Frankenstein mode. Is it more like this? If anybody remembers Carl Sagan's Cosmos, and I'll refer to it again next week because I love that show. I grew up watching it all the time. I mean, is this it? Some dark world that doesn't look like ours with lightning strikes in the background, things like that. Or is this really more of your idea of organic soup? Anywhere along those lines, you're okay. We're going to discuss a little bit more. Specifically, the Miller-Urey experiment is what we'll all know. We may not know the name, but you probably recognize it. Big glass bulb, lots of ingredients, lightning strikes, and things like that. This is based on a concept that had actually been come from before him by this gentleman up here, Operin. He came up with the general idea that if you took the initial ideas of and the compounds and the elements of life and put them together and added energy in some kind of a format, you could probably produce the amino acids and the basis of life. If you could do that, if you could create the basis of life, there's really no idea of the reason why you couldn't come up with the rest. I mean, it makes sense. So they tried this. Many different forms, many different ways. The 1952, this specific experiment was tried. It actually has been done for years and years and years since. They've done it for 10 years at a time, I think up to 15 years, where they've concentrated this goop and boiled it and stuff like that. And in actuality, they were able to come up with about 20 different amino acids. There's 21 basic amino acids. These aren't all of them, and they're not even all of them, but there's 21 basic acids, amino acids that you need for life. Some of them were out of this 20, which is an indication to show that maybe you can create this stuff. The problem is when you start digging into the experiment, and this is the reason why you don't hear about it anymore, is because there's a certain couple of problems. Initially, they thought that methane, ammonia, water vapor, a few other ingredients were the basic building blocks of life. You know, you've seen these whenever you watch these science movies about the dinosaurs running through and stuff. Well, they pretty much concluded that it wasn't even close to what the original Earth looked like. Well, that's a problem. If you don't have the initial conditions, you don't have what you need for life. Second of all, the presence of water itself break down amino acids in their creation. And this is there's a lot of good articles about this now, but the fact that the amino acids you need for life can't be formed in water. It's a little harder to explain how the organic soup of the ocean was creating life if water's a necessary component, and at the same time would break down the amino acids that have to come from it. Things like that. Finally, the concepts between genes and enzymes, and we'll get into the differences and things like that, but genes need enzymes, and enzymes need genes to be able to work at the same time. You can't have one to create the other. You have to have them both basically at the same time to do most of the formulas. this is the type of thing that eventually killed this project. And for most people, though it's still interesting and sometimes it's quoted, usually it's out of context and usually it's only in small pieces. So keep that in mind as you think of science and some of the failings of our current understanding of science to bring these things together. We started with Didi and looking at some of the very large stuff and some of the very, very small, weird stuff. What I want to do is I want to look for a minute at some of those basic qualities that you need for life. I mean, what does it take to create life in the universe? Like I said, later we'll deal with the little nuggets themselves as they work. But there's a couple of things that you need. These ideas, as you look at, require some very fine tuning, as the term is called. They have to be within specific ranges, and if you go outside those ranges, you're going to wind up going too far this way or too far that way, and you can't actually build the components of life itself, whether it be on the stellar level, whether it be at the microscopic level, all this stuff. So I want to look at a few of them. I'm going to put them up on screen. These are a few. You don't have to read through all of them, but you can kind of look through a few of them. There's a few more that we go through, and they're all very interesting. The problem is you keep going and going and going and going and going. We're almost there. Going and going. And when you're almost done, you get one more. So for those who couldn't see all those and want to get a better idea, I put them all together so you can get a better chance to look at them. Hopefully that helps along the way. Okay, so what does it help with? Okay, great. So the guy who composed all this together, his name is Hugh Ross. He's a very famous Christian apologist. He's also a scientist. But be that as it may, the man's a Christian apologist. They have a tendency to be looked at kind of dubiously. We've got a slanted view on science and all this stuff. His PhD in astrophysics aside, it's possible that Mr. Ross, or Dr. Ross, is trying to show just one view of it. So what I wanted to do is I want to go back and look at some of his sources to get an idea of the non-Christian sources he draws from, to try and put those together. And I wanted to fit them on a slide. It was kind of hard. I started messing with the font to make sure we get enough to be able to look at. To say that, you know, we can look at what Ross is looking at without dealing with just a Christian scientist viewpoint. So I put them up so you all could read through them. It was a little hard because they're not in alphabetical order, so I put them in alphabetical order for you. I've actually never actually had to write anything at font 4 to try and get them all on the page. But suffice it to say, there's 156 different resources here to pull from that he draws these 93 ideas and the variables that are necessary for life. What does that mean? It means it's a little bit more complex than your average scientist is going to let you onto. And why? Because it takes away from some of the scientific rationalism that we're going to come up with. So going back to the things we want to consider. The thing that Didi and I are both trying to point out is the fact that science and religion are not in conflict. Man's understanding of it might be, but that does not take away from the understanding that they both have. I'll read a little bit, bear with me as I read. So Merriam-Webster defines science as knowledge about or study of the natural world based on facts learned through experiments and observation. Okay, and that makes sense. That's what we use for science. It presupposes a couple of things along the way, and that you have an understanding, that you have that observer. I always love the idea of the quantum mechanic idea of there has to be an observer to notice what's going on. It always makes you wonder what happens when you turn around, what's the experiment doing behind your back. But I mean, it kind of makes sense. You have to view these things. But we don't really understand what that even means. I mean, like I said, some of the tunneling ones, the thing that blows my mind at all. Things that can just tunnel through things on their own, whenever they want to do it. This is science as we understand it. It will continue to evolve. But it also points out the same thing about religion. I mean, let's take Merriam-Webster again. An organized system of beliefs, ceremonies, and rules used to worship a god or a group of gods, or I'll say the god, and I'll put that part in. But what is Bible, what does the acronym Bible stand for? Do you all remember this one? Basic instruction before leaving Earth. The emphasis on basic instruction, so you kind of build from there. I would argue it's an attempt by man to learn and understand so that we can walk and worship with our God. But again, it's our understanding of how to do these things. We do not understand these things perfectly. I'd quote 1 Corinthians 13:12, and I always like the King James Version because it always sounds cooler. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as I also am known. I think it's a good point. We don't get it right now. We're fallen basic creatures trying to learn our way through these things. We understand and we act in the way we do it. We are committed yet imperfect creatures trying to act in God's stead. That's what we're trying to do. And in both, in science and in religion, we're trying to do the best we can to put these things together until we make it to heaven and actually see what's really, really there. And one might say, even if you don't go to heaven, just see what's really there. So looking at some of the takeaways, looking at God hovering over the water, is it necessarily difficult to think that God might have reached into the water and created these things to bring the life that actually came to exist? And I'm not going to argue old earth, young earth, the possibilities of all these things, what needs to be taken along the way. Because a lot of these things are just not understood. We just don't get it. I mean, I'd be happy to discuss the issue, but to argue fundamentally that one has to be over the other, I think that's where really where science gets it wrong by trying to say it dogmatically has to be one or the other. We can discuss this all the time. I mean, good gracious, how many discussions do we have within a biblical framework of did Jesus doodle in the sand or was he drawing something imperative when the prostitute or the adulterous woman was brought to him? I had this great sermon one time I listened to that Jesus was doodling. I was wondering, what was he doodling? I mean, I think everybody would stand around and watch that instead. But the question is, was he or was he doing something or was he drawing some imperative for people to read? We don't know. And it's not necessarily imperative to know. What's imperative to know is what came of the situation that he discussed. So Genesis 2:22, the reason I brought that one up is because, again, we have an understanding, trying to explain how these things work. We now talk about the fact that we do build things out of other people's body parts and things like that. I mean, how crazy is that? We transplant hearts and all things like that. I'd like not to think about trying to transplant brains because mostly I'd be very scared to see what happened if mine was in somebody else's body, but the concepts are there. I mean, these things are developing as we go over time. And then the last one, I really found this one interesting, the Leviticus quote about a possible injunction against trying to create genetic mutation. And especially as we discuss whether Monsanto is Satan itself or whether some of these other organizations that are trying to look into genetic research, and as we push the bounds of the genetic markers that, by the way, Francis Collins, a Christian, was the one who first typed out the human genome and understood what it all meant, what those things will mean for science for later on. It's something to consider. So with that in mind, I took a look at Psalm 19:1, and it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands." And I kind of said, well, what if we rewrote it a little bit, more of a biological sense? What if we put DNA into the middle of it? Would it make more sense for us as a people? So I challenge you to take a look, and I'm not sure that I necessarily hit all the points, but just think about it as we kind of go along. With that, I'm going to spend a little bit of time kind of going into next week's, and we'll have a little more discussion on this. The concept of Darwinism has brought up quite a bit, and a lot of the new atheists, especially Dawkins, likes to propose Dawkins as the quintessential nature to push against creationists. And first of all, one has to look back at Darwin's life to see that there's enough controversy about whether what he believed and what he didn't anyway, so I think that Mr. Dawkins might be a little off to begin with. But let's just take it from the point of view of the components. There's three basic pillars, I'll refer to them, in Darwinism. It's random mutation, natural selection, and long periods of time. We're going to look at this a little bit more next week as I kind of discuss what that actually entails, but think of it this way. Random mutation we know exists, okay? We know, we see things, I mean, that's what cancer is to a great extent, is this the continued growth of mutated cells and things like that. We know it exists, but the question is how often does it happen? What does it do? And what are the limits that mutation might actually happen? Are there bounds with which things are not going to happen? I mean, everybody likes the Marvel superheroes, right? We have yet to see Spider-Man come out. I'm still looking. You know, Captain America's magic formula has not been created. Some of these things may be outside the bounds of even the potential of science. Natural selection. Anybody remember Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom? Okay, yeah, some of us are like, what? But okay, just look it up. It's on YouTube, I guarantee it is. You only have to watch one or two of those episodes to notice two things. The guy running the show is always sitting with a cup of tea in the corner while his assistant's out there running after the tiger. And the second thing is that nature, in fact, is, as Darwin was said, it is red in tooth and claw. We know that natural selection happens. We know that stronger takes out weaker and things like this along the way. But it's a general concept. You can't push it too far. If you go too far in these concepts, you'll lose the bubble of what you're actually trying to prove. Natural selection does certain things. But there has to be a force to guide it. And the question is, what guides the natural selection process? In long periods of time. This actually is an interesting one. And I'm going to show this next week, I think. I hope to do so. Long periods of time may actually be a harder thing for atheists to accept than for Christians. It actually may be possible to show that a long earth, an old earth, may be harder for atheists to try and explain with the concepts of intelligence, consciousness, sexuality, and all the other bases for which we drive actually comes about. And I'll show you the reason why. It has a lot to do with the fact that more things came earlier in time than we actually give it credit for. And this is coming via science, which is proving the Bible more and more. So I just challenge you to keep that in mind. And if you ever have a chance, look up the concept of Darwin's dilemma. Even in his own time, he realized that some of these pillars, if they were challenged, would destroy his argument. And he was very good about at least admitting that. So looking forward, I'll leave you with this quote. Hopefully this is not what Dee Dee and I have done to you along the way. but what we want to do is discuss next week. I'm going to be looking at the unlikelihood of life's continuance on Earth, and we'll kind of expand that a little bit more. Are there any questions real fast? I kind of jammed through some of this a little bit quickly, but I want to make sure that we still have a chance. Next week, I'm going to cover a few more things, so please. Oh, no, it totally makes sense. And I'm going to close it out real quick, Susan. You have to, and forgive me, I hate sitting, so I have a tendency to walk, but if I do that, nobody ever stares at my slides. I think that's an absolutely great question. And I think the basis of it is simple. What it starts with, and what the new atheists, strange enough, try to push against, is the concept of an objective moral reality. And if you ever look anything into their read, they'll try and tell you there is no basis for objective moral reality. There's no basis for truth. Well, once you start to struggle with that, you understand that there's nowhere to go, and there's nowhere to climb to, if you will. So I think our ability to explain where objective moral reality and objective truth comes from is actually answer that question. Now, whether our reading of the Bible, whether it be the KJV, whether it be the NIV, the ESV, or any of the rest of them, actually explained it best for us to understand, and whether or not science is actually going to climb that mountain to get where they're at, I think that's the question. I think so in answer, the real answer to the question is there's a truth there. And I think what it is, both sides are coming at it quickly. There's a, I have to paraphrase it, there's an old statement, I think it was by a scientist who said, you know, what's going to happen one of these days is with all the science, we're climbing the mountain and learning more. We're going to finally get to the summit. And as we crest it, we're going to look up. And what we'll see is we'll see the philosophers having sat there for hundreds of years with already the answers telling us that Christ was the one who was doing it. I think that's where we'll get. I think the Bible helps us get to that better understanding. But again, our understanding is it's a perfect book that we are trying to understand from an imperfect lens. And science, the truth is there. Not to quote the X-Men or the X-Files, but the truth's there. We're trying to climb there, and it's our understanding along the way. Those truths are what we're trying to get to. The mechanisms we get to that are where we get better and better and better, and hopefully we will eventually get to that when we're in heaven and we can actually ask the guys who created it. Make sense? Anything else? Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.